have some of your evil powers. That's good.
Yeah, it's working. Lena, do you need to look at this again? No, I think I got it. Remember, you checked it before. I think it's okay.
Is that red record button not blinking?
It's not blinking anymore.
Okay, yeah.
So we're good?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, fabulous people. Let's do this. Are we ready? Oh, Amanda is so ready. She has, like, Coke for a lifetime over there. That's, like, bigger than your head, that bottle right there. That's huge. Okay. All right, let's pray. Sorry we're late. Lord Jesus, thank you so much for this time, for bringing us all here tonight, Lord. And we're in the middle of the semester, Lord. I'm sure people are starting to get weary and in the middle of papers and midterms and all kinds of stuff. And so, Lord, just strengthen each one, God. I pray that you would quicken our spirits to be able to receive from you tonight, Lord, to hear from you, whatever it is that you want to speak to us. We love you, Lord. You've been so good to us. And so we want to just respond by just taking in whatever it is that you have for us tonight. Bless it, Lord, and help me to communicate clearly. And just go before it. So we commit it all to you. We thank you. We acknowledge you. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. So I forgot to tell you guys, we are not completely, but we're going to change a couple of things. I'm going to tweak the syllabus because I was supposed to talk about Archibald and Flora Glover today. We were going to do them, right? It's on your syllabus. We were going to do the Glovers. They were a couple that survived the Boxer Rebellion of 1900, a mass, killing spree, basically, against, missionaries and Chinese Christians in the year 1900. That's what we were going to talk about. And here, I'll just show you a picture of them. There they are, Archibald and Flora Glover. So we were going to talk about them and go through China and all the things that they did. But I just changed my mind. I decided to skip them, and we're just going to jump to Gladys Aylward. And then what we're going to do is we're not going to talk about the Glovers at all. For some reason, I just felt like we should instead insert Barclay Buxton and Paget Wilkes. So somewhere along the way, that's who we're going to talk about. They were missionaries in Japan. And I just thought, well, maybe better to cover, because we talk a lot about people in China, so I thought maybe we'll cover something a little bit different. So, all right? Do we have any complaints about that? Are you, so upset that we're not going to talk about the Glovers, who you probably never heard of anyway? Okay. Good.
Missionaries you just mentioned in our book, though?
They shouldn't be. I don't think. They're pretty obscure. Their story was it's not really as well known. So.
I remember reading Wilkes. I read the book.
Oh, Paget Wilkes would be. I thought you were talking about the Glovers, so you wouldn't know them. But yeah, but Paget Wilkes is in your book?
I remember.
I think he is.
Name,
oh, wow. Okay, maybe.
Okay.
All right. Oh, that's cool. All right. Yeah, but they're not quite as commonly known, so I thought, well, we'll pull those guys out and look at them too. So, so obviously tonight we're going to talk about another British missionary, and she was in China, the same region as some of these other people we've talked about, but she kind of had her own thing going on, and her name, of course, as you see, Gladys Aylward. And she was, as we're going to see, a very normal, ordinary person. And God likes to use normal, ordinary people, right, for his purposes, as we're going to see. And so, interestingly, in retrospect, looking back on her life, people say that she was the most noted single woman missionary in modern history, looking back on her life. But at the time she lived, and when she first tried to become a missionary, she was considered unqualified. And so she was completely passed over. They thought she was unlikely. She was very unfitted for the mission field. That's how she was viewed in her time. So again, she was a very average and ordinary person and very simple, a very simple woman that God used for his glory because she met the one prerequisite that we talk about every week. What is it, guys? No, not that one. Oh, what's our verse? Daniel 11:32. The people who know their God will be strong and oh my goodness. I got to work on you guys. The people, Ian, nice to see you, sir. Hey, there he is. Okay, I'll scratch you off. You're here. All right. The people who know their God will be strong and carry out great exploits. Yes. All right. We got it. All right, the people who know their God. And that's what Gladys Aylward had. She knew her God. That was it, right? And remember what I always say. The way we know God is how we're going to live our lives, right? The way you know God determines how you are going to live. And that is what we see, obviously, in her life. And she walked in the simplicity of just knowing her God. And we're going to see that with her. She was just a very simple person. So that's the thing you want to note down about her life, okay? The characteristic of Gladys Aylward, simplicity, okay? I'm even afraid to ask you guys if we remember all the other characteristics of the other people we've talked about. Oh my goodness, everyone go home and memorize Daniel 11:32 this week, okay? You should know this by now, people. I know John said mighty, and that's okay. I mean, you guys were throwing out synonyms for, I don't know. Maybe that was probably from English Standard Version, right? Another translation. Mm-hmm. I'll just throw, yeah. All right, so she was simple. Gladys was born in North London, February of 1902. She was born into a very average, lower working class family. When she was 14, she became a parlor maid. So those of you who watch things like Downton Abbey probably know what that is. All right, the maids were, you know, just a parlor maid was actually a step above maybe like the gals who worked downstairs or the tweenies or some of the other maids around the house. But she was still a maid nonetheless. So she was basically just a house servant. And it wasn't exactly, you know, it didn't exactly rake in the dough. So she spent the next several years in domestic service as a parlor maid, leading a very mundane, normal life. But that's the kind of life that characterized loads of lower class single women in that day and age. You know, a lot of single gals, they went into service and you pretty much just did that your whole life a lot of times. You know, you'd get promoted up and be like a lady's maid or something like that. But once you were in domestic service, that's usually what you stayed doing for quite a while, unless you like got married or something like that. So obviously she didn't have, the very prominent background or anything, no glamour, none of that. But again, it was the simplicity even of this life in her early years that kind of formed Gladys's character and perspective as time went on. So one day, and I'm not sure exactly when this was, she's probably in her early 20s, she went to a revival church meeting and then she was given opportunity to accept Christ, and she did. And that really began to revolutionize her life, right? And we see that with a lot of these people. Coming to know Jesus was suddenly what gave purpose and meaning to everything that they did. And it gave them a focus for their lives. And so Gladys started to get involved with Young Life. You guys familiar with Young Life? I went a little bit. Yeah, when I was in high school, I went to Young Life for a little bit. Yeah. Okay, so it's still going. So this was just, you know, obviously a ministry to young people. And so she started going to Young Life ministry meetings. And that's when, what? Oh, okay, nothing. Oh, yeah, that's right. And Gladys was obviously a cool kid. So the Lord placed on her heart during this time the desire to really go all out for him, you know, in a fresh way. And she didn't know what this looked like yet, but she was like, okay, Lord, I'm going to serve you with my life. That's what I'm going to do. So one day she was sitting on a bus and reading Young Life magazine, and she noticed a statement in the magazine. It said, planes can now fly over the vast country of China, but there are millions there who have never heard the gospel. And this totally caught her attention. And so she started praying like, wow, Lord, you know, people need you in China. You need to send somebody really great over there. Somebody needs to go to China and reach all of these people. And so her biographer said, Gladys started a one-woman campaign. She would persuade someone to go to China as a missionary. She started by contacting all of the important people that she knew, because only the best was good enough for God. Some talented and clever person must go there. But it wasn't happening, you know. She's like trying to impart vision to somebody who just, you know, didn't have it. So she's going around trying to recruit somebody with, you know, somebody with clout, somebody with power, or somebody with authority, or somebody who had some kind of skill to go over to China. And it just wasn't, you know, nothing was taking off. So finally, her brother asked her why she didn't just go. He was getting kind of annoyed with her at this point. He's like, dude, Gladys, all you do is talk about China. Why don't you just go there? Why are you trying to send somebody else? Maybe it's time for you to just step up to the plate. And Gladys was like, you got to be kidding me. Not me. You know, that's not what's needed over there. They need somebody who can actually have influence and have an effect over there. She felt completely inadequate and ridiculous. But from her brother just making this little comment, God started to slowly put the conviction on her heart that, man, maybe I really could. I mean, I really do care. I really do want to see God do something there. And so she decided to become a missionary to China. And at the age of 28, So in 1930, she went off to the China Inland Mission offices in London to apply for service. And so she goes through 3 months of all this training and these tests. She's all excited and hopeful at like, okay, what's God going to do? Where are they going to send me? I can't, you know, she was stoked, all ready to go. Only to be told by the local director that she was not fit for service in China. Bum, bum, bum. I know. So sad. The hammer falls. So, funny you should ask. Here's what her biographer said. The director recognized and acknowledged her strength of character, but was worried by her lack of education because she was so bad in academic stuff. I mean, she just completely flunked the academic subjects. But remember, she's a maid. It's not like she had, like, years of education and everything. I mean, I think, you know, she knew how to read and do the basics, but she didn't really have anything else going on up here, okay? So, also, her age was not ideal, especially for learning a foreign language as complicated as Chinese. They usually tried to send over younger people that could adjust to foreign languages quicker. And again, Chinese is like, what, the hardest language in the world to learn? So that's a major strike against her as far as they were concerned, which is kind of ironic when you remember Hudson Taylor, who we talked about last week, right, and how he was all about bringing in the uneducated masses. He didn't care as long as people had a heart for Jesus and a heart for sharing the gospel. That was his focus, right? But here we are about 25 years after Hudson Taylor died, and you can see the mission is already like starting to kind of, you know, narrow down their requirements a little bit more. But I'm sure some of that had to do with what they had seen as being most effective. And so they're like, people like Gladys, they're just not going to, you know, you can't cut it, honey. It's not going to happen. So her biographer said, she hardly heard the voice which reiterated her list of failures. She knew she could never make him understand. She knew that she lacked persuasiveness to argue with him or the education to pass his examinations. She knew she didn't have the background. She knew she didn't have a chance. But she also knew with a single-minded, agonizing clearness that she must go to China. So by this time, she just knew this was a call from God. And it's like, you know, she didn't know how to put that into words or explain it in a way that anyone would understand, but she knew she needed to go. And so, again, with the simplicity that was so characteristic of her, she decided, well, God called me to go, so I guess I have to go, even if nobody else will support me, even if I can't get a ministry or a mission backing me up, I guess I just got to go without any sponsor. And I love that about her. I love that because I think this is a great encouragement for anyone who feels unqualified, you know, to do whatever it is the Lord's called them to do. And it could be anything, right? Not necessarily just missions, but anyone who feels unqualified, not good enough or smart enough, not outgoing enough, you know, whatever the case may be. Because sometimes, you know, you look at the great men and women of the faith, even some of the ones we've been talking about, and you can find, you know, you see where they maybe had their act together in at least one area, maybe what, you know, because of their intellect, their social status, personality, whatever the case may be. But when you come to a person like Gladys Aylward, who had absolutely nothing going for her at all, and that should be an encouragement to us, you know? If we get discouraged even trying to step out and have faith that God can do anything with us, hey, you look at Gladys Aylward and you realize it doesn't matter. When God calls you to do something, all that stuff doesn't matter. All those externals, all those peripheral things, it just doesn't matter. If God is calling you to do something, he's going to get you there. He's going to equip and empower you to do that. And so here's Gladys Aylward, basically a missionary reject. But the simplicity of her faith and God's call pushed her past the impossibilities, right, that man set up before her, to see God's possibilities. And that's what faith does, right? It'll always look beyond the impossibilities to see the potential, right? To see the possibilities that are there with God. And so she pretty much just stepped out, and we're going to see God did a lot of crazy stuff through her. So her mind was made up in spite of the China Inland Mission's decision. So she began trying to earn her way to China on her own. And at first she was kind of like, well, I don't want to be a maid anymore. I'm so burnt out on that job, you know. Bless you. She just thought it was kind of a waste of time. She's like, I should be doing something that's going to train me better for China. But eventually she realized, you know what, this is what I'm trained to do. This is what I'm good at. It's the only thing on my resume. So I guess it's back into service for me. And so it really was the best job for her, you know, in terms of being able to earn and save money. That really was the ideal. So she decided, you know, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to go all out. I mean, she'd take on extra hours and do extra work because she figured, hey, as long as I can, the faster I can save money, the faster I'll be able to get to China. So at that time, she went to a travel agency to find out what the cost for a ticket to China would be. And most people took boat by then, back then, right? So the slow boat to China, old saying. And that was the common method, but she wanted the absolute cheapest ticket possible. She's like, okay, I just, you know, I don't care what I have to do. I just, you know, I really don't have enough money for a boat. So what should I do? So the clerk mentioned briefly and very hesitantly, he said, well, you could take a train through Russia and Siberia. But for 47 pounds, that's what it cost back then. But, you know, he was like, I really, really highly, you know, strongly recommend that you not do that because it's really unstable over there right now. I mean, this was the 1930s, so it's like Stalin's purges are going on over there. It's like nobody wants to just cruise through communist Russia during this time. And so he was just like, you really, lady, I mean, there is a train, but you really shouldn't get on it. And so, of course, as you can probably guess, Gladys didn't mind that at all. She's like, sweet, there's a train. That's all she heard was there's a train through Russia. I'll do that. So she's very simple. She just heard the call to go, and she was going to obey that call, and it didn't really matter. And so before the clerk could really throw out all his protests of why she shouldn't do this, Gladys took £3 cash, and you guys know pounds is English currency, right? Okay, I'll know that, just making sure. Put it down on the counter and said, that's wonderful. Will you just put this on account for me, and I'll come back and pay you until I get 47 pounds, you know, and then I'll get my ticket to China. And so she put it there on the counter, and the guy was getting kind of frustrated with her at this point. He's like, look, lady, for one thing, we don't do payment plans. That's not how we roll here. You know, you can't just give me £3 and come in next week, and, you know, we don't do that. And we also don't like to deliver our customers dead. So if we send you through Russia, that's probably what's going to happen. It's very unlikely that you're going to survive. So he's just like throwing out all of this stuff at her, but she just kept saying, oh, they won't worry about me. I'm a woman. It's fine. I'm just, look at me. They don't care. They're not going to bother with me. Stalin doesn't care about me. So eventually the clerk was just so frustrated. He's like, okay, fine, whatever. So he took the money and Gladys walked out, la, 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 like all happy on her merry way, knowing that she was starting to earn her money towards China. So having that settled, she next began to consider the fact that, you know, even if she wasn't the most qualified or educated person in the world, she could do something to try to prepare and equip herself practically. So she's like, well, what I really need to do is know my Bible really well if I'm going to go over there to China. If I'm going to be a missionary, I better know the Bible. Very simple, but, you know, very smart. That was the right thing to do. And she figured maybe I better learn how to preach or something like that. I need to get used to public speaking. And so her biographer said, with the essential simplicity which characterized her, in every moment of spare time, she went to Hyde Park or any street corner where she literally mounted a soapbox and preached. So she did. She just got up on a little box, and she's a short little lady. I don't know if you can tell in that picture, but, you know, she's like Mary Slessor. All these really short people just did all these amazing things. So all of you who are short, take heart. Anyway, so she's basically getting up, and Hyde Park in London, I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but there's a place in Hyde Park called Speaker's Corner, okay, and it's still there. You can go by there, and people are all out there talking about whatever. A lot of times we've had, like, you know, people from the church and missionaries and different ones go over there and do outreaches and stuff in Hyde Park. So that's what she did. She went to Speaker's Corner, basically, where all these other people are speaking, got on her little box and started, Jesus loves you, you know, sharing the gospel and whatever. So she was just getting some practice. And I love that because there wasn't a formula. There wasn't like a strategy, you know. She wasn't trying to reach a certain focus group or something like this. She just, you know, went out there and just started doing what she thought needed to be done, you know. Simple common sense, action, and obedience to the Lord. And so it's really sweet. We see that her whole life. The Lord just worked through her in a very uncomplicated way. So she continues on just, you know, focusing on her goal of getting to China, and then the Lord opened the next door for her because China is just, you know, humongous, and she had no specific direction at this point. She just knows, I want to go to that country. And so somebody told her about this elderly woman named Jeannie Lawson who had been working on her own in China for years. And apparently Jeannie, you know, she was getting up there. She's in her 70s, and she wanted a younger woman to come and take over the work that she was doing. And Gladys just knew in her heart, like, dude, that's me. I'm that girl. And so she wrote to Mrs. Lawson. And now she felt like she had a specific sense of direction and purpose. And this is when she really threw herself into her work even more. She did all she could to earn extra money. She sacrificed some of her own possessions in order to get more money for China. In one instance, she went through this cheap shoe sale, and she found two left shoes that were her size. You know, she was small, so she had really small feet. It was hard to find shoes that were her size. So she found two left shoes that didn't even match, but they were her size. And so she's like, well, I guess I'll just get these. And then she sold her nice leather ones so that she would have extra money to get to China. And so, I know, so her biographer said, she told nobody until later that she traveled all the way to China in shoes that were both for left feet. She never regretted the purchase of the shoes, but her feet later paid the price. Heck yeah. So anyways, she made it there, but I don't know how she didn't do a lot of walking the rest of her life. No, I'm just kidding. But anyways, it was pretty brutal. But man, sacrifices that these people make, right? For even in little things like this, for what they feel God calling them to do. So her savings started to grow little by little. And by now, the clerk at the travel agency was an old friend. He just knew every Friday Gladys was going to come in and give him two or three more pounds to add to, you know, her account for that ticket. And finally, Gladys got a letter from Jeannie Lawson inviting her to come and work with her, kind of an official, okay, here we are. You can come. And so if she could just get to the town of Tientsin, somebody would meet her there and then take her to Jeannie. So she's like, okay, that's the goal. Tientsin, China. I have no idea where that is, but that's where I need to get. And so, of course, Gladys is over the moon, and so she starts making arrangements to leave. And so October 18, 1932, she departed from London on that train bound for China. And with her, she carried everything she owned, which only filled two suitcases. And so I'm like, I don't think there's a woman in Orange County that could possibly make that happen. So I'd be surprised. But so she had two little suitcases, and one of the suitcases, she just put a bunch of food in it, which was actually kind of smart. She was being very practical, so I guess she just had, like, barely any clothes. But she's a maid, you know? How many clothes is she going to wear? She's just got, like, her little black and white little apron thing and stuff. So not that she would – never mind. So she packed one little case with her personal belongings. The other one just had food, which was smart because she hardly had any money. She had £2, 9 pence in cash to her name, which – how much would that be? 15 bucks, 20 bucks, maybe, something like that. I don't know. Maybe a little bit more than that. But, I mean, hardly anything. I mean, honestly, so it's like, yeah, you better bring food with you. You're not going to get very far. So talk about going out in faith. She just was like, this is all I've got, so I'm going to just go. And, Lord, you called me, so we'll just see what you're going to do. I mean, how many people would really step out and go do something like that nowadays, right? We all have our common sense and our, you know, this is how we should do things. And we, you know, we've got to research and make sure that we've got all our ducks in a row. She didn't have any ducks in a row, right? She didn't have any ducks. She had nothing, right? So she heads out in faith. And, oh my gosh, I can't believe this, you guys. My foot's starting to cramp, just like last week. Okay, this is a tradition now. All right, so I'm going to try to ignore this. So the journey went on for several days. After about 10 days, the train crosses into Siberia. So she's going overland, okay, through Western Europe, Eastern Europe. They're going into Russia now, going over this, the long way over to China. Do you guys know your geography enough to know what I'm talking about? Trans-Siberian, there we go. So she's going over on the train. I can't even imagine 10 days on a train. That would just drive me nuts. So at one point, and, you know, she's starting to get around, you know, it's mostly like Russian people. Nobody's speaking English anymore. There was one person who told her that she was probably going to get held up at the border of Manchuria and not make it to Tientsin at all. They're like, you know, just want to let you know, lady, you're probably not going to get where you're trying to go. But she's like, that's okay. We'll get there. It's going to be fine. So she stayed on the train. And pretty soon there were these Russian soldiers that were starting to get on the train. Like at every stop, there's more and more soldiers coming on. She's like, oh, okay, this is getting kind of interesting here. And basically they kind of commandeered the train so they could use it for like a military op. And the conductor was like trying to get her off, you know, because, again, nobody spoke English. They're all looking at her like, you know, get out of here. However you say that, you would know. So our token Russian people in here. So anyways, so he's trying to get her off the train. She won't go. And just, again, she just kind of had that mindset. Well, every mile forward is a mile toward China, so I'll stay here as long as I can possibly stay on this train. So inevitably, the train did stop. You know, it got to a point where the Russian troops were like, okay, this is where we want this train to end. So the train stops. They're like, sorry, lady, you can't go any farther. So she got out of the train and had to walk through the snow and through this wolf-infested forest for over a day just to get back to the nearest village. But of course, at the time, she didn't realize like the imminent danger, you know, of the wolves. And she could hear them like howling at night, and she thought, you know, that somebody had their dogs outside or something like that. She's like, oh, that's an interesting sound. And she was thinking, who let the dogs out? I'm just kidding. I had to say it. So terrible, I know. So Gladys finally made it back to the village. Thanks. I'm glad you can appreciate that. I'll be here all night, folks. All right. So she makes it back to the village. Eventually, these officials bring her in to interview her, supposedly. But there was a mix-up with her passport because it said on her passport that her profession was missionary. And so the Russians thought that it said machinery. Like, oh, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, so like, machinery, oh, you work in a factory, okay. So that's what they think she does. I know that was terrible, sorry. So she showed them, so she's like, no, wait a minute. So she showed them her Bible, and they're like, oh, okay. And she thought they understood, and they were catching on. So they rerouted her tickets, supposedly to get her to the right place. So she ends up in Vladivostok, and this police officer of some sort, I don't know. And I don't know what kind of officer he was, but anyways, he meets her there at the train and kind of just decides that he's going to be her escort, and she has no idea what's going on. I mean, this whole time she hasn't talked to anybody in English for days, and she's just kind of rolling with it here. She gets off the train, this guy meets her, he takes her passport away from her and starts escorting her around the city, whether she liked it or not. So here he is, he's like showing her the city of Vladivostok and all the glories of communist Russia and all this stuff, and he's taking her to all these factories and things, and she's just like, what the heck is this? You know, what are we doing? And then she started to dawn on her, oh, shoot, they still think I'm a machinist. They're trying to get me. So, and that's what was happening. They were trying to recruit her to come work in their factories for Mother Russia. So, that was day one, was touring all the factories of Vladivostok. She's like, sweet, I don't know how I feel about this. So she's at his mercy. He has her passport. He's just showing her around and everything. So on her second day there, you know, the guy, I don't know, this guy, he was with her, like, all the time. Like, she couldn't really get away or anything. But he stepped aside for some reason to do something. And the minute he was gone, this random girl, this young girl comes up to her. And surprisingly, the girl spoke English. And again, Gladys hadn't seen this in days. She's like, oh, my gosh, an English speaker. I think I'm going to die. So the girl explained that Gladys was in danger, which I think she was pretty, you know, it was pretty obvious at this point. Like, yeah, you think? She's like, okay, Gladys. Well, she didn't say Gladys. She didn't know her name. But she said, okay, you're in danger. You need to get your passport back. And here's what you need to do. Tonight at your hotel, a man's going to come to your door after midnight. He's going to knock softly on the door. Just open the door. Don't say anything. And just follow him. It's like, okay. I mean, this is so like, come on, seriously? But, you know, at this point, I think she was willing to do anything. She's like, the last thing I want to do is work in a factory here and become a communist. So, she's like, okay, so remember, she's very simple. She's just kind of rolling with it. Okay, whatever. So Gladys was able to get her passport back, and that in itself was a miracle because the guy did not want to give it back to her at all. He was kind of intimidating her and all this sort of thing, kind of mind gaming. But she finally got her passport back, and then sure enough, after midnight, she hears a little knock on the door, opens the door, and the mystery man is there. She just quietly follows him down and outside. So they go out to the shipyard, where the girl was waiting, and she's like recognizes the girl, and she's like, oh my gosh, here you are. So the girl tells Gladys that she needs to get on board the ship, and she said, you know, the ship is sailing for Japan. I know that's not where you want to go, but this is your only hope of getting out of Russia. And so she thanked the girl and just, you know, gave her something, whatever she could to show her appreciation, because it was just like, who is this girl? And she's not getting anything out of this, out of helping me. Where did this even come from? The whole thing was so bizarre. So Gladys gets on the ship, and she goes to the captain, And she said, I'm a British citizen. I'm trying to get to China. And as soon as he saw her British passport, he's like, oh, okay, you can come for free. So she gets on the ship, and she's ready to go. So this was a total God thing. There is no other explanation for this. It's just so random out of nowhere, right? I personally think that this girl was an angel that just, like, randomly, like, showed up. So, yeah, that's right. But again, I love how Gladys simply just walked through whatever came up. Even though she was afraid, and, you know, she's dealing with all these unknowns and crazy things, but she's just kind of, you know, what else is she going to do? You know, she's kind of just got to entrust herself to the Lord at this point. And we see how the Lord would continue to lead her. And we're going to continue to see more things happen. So Gladys gets to Japan, and she finds missionaries there that will, missionaries, to help her get tickets to China. And finally, November of 1932, so this is weeks after she'd originally left London. You know, she was supposed to be there long before this, but this is, you know, taking the long way around, definitely. She finally gets to Tientsin, which was the town... Oh, I didn't write it up there. Tientsin was the town that Jeannie Lawson was supposed to meet her in. And so she gets there, and what? I wrote it up there? No, that's Sei Chow. That's a different one.
How long did you say it took her to get there?
Oh, several weeks, maybe like 4 weeks or something like that. It wasn't supposed to take that long, so... So there were some missionaries there that had heard of Jeannie Lawson, and they knew that she lived way out in the mountains, possibly in the village of Sei Chow. That's where they last had heard that she lived. And they told her, it's going to take a few more weeks to get there, but we'll make sure you get there. So she's like, oh, great, that's the last thing I need is another long, you know, long-haul trip here. So a month later, she finally gets to Sei Chow, only to discover that she had to go another few days to find Jeannie Lawson because Jeannie had recently moved to Yangcheng. But I put those two towns on the board because those are the most significant towns that we'll keep coming back to. So Jeannie Lawson had just moved to Yangcheng, and that's where she would find her. And so Gladys finally gets there. She's like so worn out. I mean, this was so anticlimactic, you know. Oh, I'm in China. I'm finally here. But she was just so tired. She didn't even care. She's like, just get me a bed. Get me some food. I just, you know, she was wiped. So, and then her first meeting with Jeannie Lawson was also pretty anticlimactic. Jeannie Lawson was this blunt old bird, and she basically just looked at Gladys and said, who are you? And she's like, oh, I'm here. I'm the one that, you know, we've been writing, and I've come to work with you. Get over here. You know, I want to give her a big hug or something. And she just looked at Gladys and was like, oh, okay, come on in. I'll show you around. I mean, like, completely, like, not even, you know, surprised, not even, like, asking her how her trip was, nothing. It was just kind of like, oh, okay, come on. So, kind of a bummer. Gladys is like, okay. So she goes in, and she starts showing her around. Jeannie starts showing her around this dilapidated, abandoned building that she had just rented. She said, I think this has a lot of potential for something. I don't know what, but I just rented this building here. And so that's Gladys Aylward's beginning of ministry in China. Ah, okay, in all its glory. So, like I said, very anticlimactic, not what she was expecting at all. Even the way life was in the village at the beginning was really hard for her. It wasn't what she expected in that way either. It took a lot of time for her to adjust to living in this village. Yang, their cook, I didn't write him up there, but Yang the cook, that was, I don't know, what he was known as. He was their only Chinese friend in the world. He was the only one who would come anywhere near them. Foreigners in general were treated with hostility and suspicion. And then you've got, you know, especially somebody like Jeannie Lawson, because, again, remember, she's an older woman, so she's 74 years old, has white hair, you know, this little Scottish lady, and so she stood out like a sore thumb. People thought she had an evil spirit, and that's why her hair was white. So they were like, we're not going anywhere near those ladies. Those ladies are foreign devils. We're like, you know, back away, stay as far away from them as you possibly can. And so for several weeks, Jeannie and Gladys had quite an ordeal just trying to settle in. Jeannie was smart, though. She'd been in China for years and years. And so she was very wise, very, you know, she had a lot of stability, and it taught Gladys not to overreact to everything, to the way, you know, because Gladys would be all upset about the fact that nobody was, you know, wanted to talk to them or anything. But she said, you know what, let's just stay about our business, just stay focused, just wait, let's just be patient here and see what God might want to do. But every time they went out into the town, people would throw mud at them and yell at them. And even after they got used to these foreign devils, bless you, being in their village, they still avoided them most of the time. And remember, we're talking inland China now. So on the coast, they were used to foreigners. But inland China, the further inland you go, they're not used to seeing all of these, you know, scary-looking white people show up. And so they just, you know, like, you know, kind of freaked them out a little bit. And so they, like I said, they continued to avoid them even when they got used to them. It wasn't like they were going to come near them. They just stayed away. So, you know, so Gladys started to get kind of, you know, frustrated, like, how are we ever going to reach these people? You know, I go anywhere close to them and they just run like, you know, cockroaches in the light, you know, they just flee. And so that was weird, cockroaches in the light. That didn't make sense. But anyways, I'm coming out with all kinds of, anyways, it's one of those nights, guys. They do. Well, thank you. It just was a weird analogy. But anyways, so, where am I? So, okay. How were they going to reach these people? That was the big question. So, Yangcheng happened to be, it turned out, an important stop on a trade route for the mule trains. Okay, so there were these mule trains that would come through all of the villages, and they just would cruise through the mountains, and the muleteers were the guys that, you know, kind of ran the mules or whatever. And so one day, Gladys was watching the pack mules and the muleteers, and she said, "Man, if we could just talk to these men, they'd carry our message for hundreds of miles throughout the whole province." And so they kept walking for a little bit, and suddenly Jeannie stopped, and she said, "Oh, that's it. We'll open up an inn for the mule trains. Why didn't I think of that before? That's a great idea. We'll open up an inn for all the muleteers, and then we can get to know them, share the gospel with them, and they can bring it around to all of the other villages." So, great idea. Gladys, though, she was kind of bummed out about this at first. She's like, "Wait a minute, we're going to start an inn? Does that mean I'm going to be a maid again? Like, I have to, like, make beds?" And, like, oh, she was so bummed. She's like, "Oh, dude, I came all the way to inland China to be a maid. Lord have mercy." So, but soon she realized what an advantage this would be. And she realized, you know what? I mean, nothing is wasted by God, right? Anything we're doing, whatever we're doing right now, whatever it is, it's not wasted. Nothing is wasted in God's economy, as I've said before. And we never know what he's going to use, because this was actually, that was her skill set. She was good at that, and it would make her a really good innkeeper, all right? And so the Lord used even her former profession in this isolated little mountain village in China. Who would have thought? So the two women and Yang, the cook, they got to work cleaning and mending the building, and pretty soon they opened the inn, and they called it the Inn of Eight Happinesses, which I put up there. Okay, that was the name of their inn. They opened for business. All right, so you think everybody's going to just start flooding into their building? No, right? Come on, you guys. You should know this answer. Man, tough crowd again tonight. Let's go, people. All right. We need major caffeine on Thursday nights, I think. So I'm like the only one with energy here. Okay, so this wasn't obviously going to be very easy. They had a nice place. They had good food, obviously. They made it all really nice, really inviting. But remember, they're still the foreign devils, right? These scary white women that nobody wants to talk to. And so, nobody's going to come, even though they've got it all set up and everything. So they had the challenge of trying to get the mule trains to come into the inn. And they realized after a little while of just standing outside and inviting people that nothing was happening. You know, it's like, okay, we got to get more aggressive here. We need to, like, start, you know, never mind. So, nothing. I was going to say another analogy, but it just wouldn't sound good. So, Jeannie's like, okay, I'm too old to do this. I can't really get in their face. So, Gladys, you need to be the one to go do the dirty work. And so, what they did was, all the mules that would come into town, you know, they've been out on these mountain trails. And so, what they would do is they'd rope all the mules together, because you can't have, like, some random mule wandering off the path, or they all fall down the mountainside, right? So you keep them all together, and then that way they don't, you know, whatever, they won't fall off. And so they're all roped together, and so as they come into the village, they're still all roped together. And so Jeannie and Gladys figured if Gladys could run out and grab the muzzle of the lead mule, she could pull it into the inn yard, and then all of the other mules would have to follow, and then the muleteer would have no choice. If he wanted to get his mules back, he'd have to come to the inn. So, you know, they pretty much were just going to force the issue here. And so, anyways, I wish I had the book. I have the book, but it's, like, out of my storage unit. Anyways, it tells the whole story about how she did this. But it was actually pretty hilarious, because she's small, you know, and she's, like, trying to run up to this mule to do something. She ended up, like, jumping on its head and, like, running, and the mule's, like, kind of blind and, like, running all over the place. It finally goes into the inn yard and everything, and the muleteers are like, "Oh, white women, no!" You know, they run away. They go and hide. Foreign double, you know, so they all run away and hide. And the mules are sitting there in the courtyard, and so it's like, well, you want to get your mules back, you got to come in. And so Yang, remember, Yang's Chinese, right? So Yang could go and talk to these people. So he went to go find the muleteers and talk them into it and be like, "No, these ladies are, you know, they won't kill you. They won't poison your food. They're safe. Come on. I work for them. Look at me, you know, so I'm okay." So finally dragged them in. And they found, once they got there, that, man, these ladies really did do, you know, they put up a good spread. They had good food, a nice place to sleep, and they even had free entertainment during their meal. Jeannie Lawson told them a story. And guess what story she told them? Yes, the gospel. I was going to say something silly, but yes, the gospel, right? She's told them stories about Jesus, basically. And so, for some time, so this was the start of, you know, their new ministry to the muleteers. And from here, once, you know, these muleteers, you know, realized they weren't getting poisoned and they weren't dying or being killed in their beds by the white foreign devils, they started to spread the news so that other people would find out. So life went on this way for a while. The inn became a popular stopping point. And then, you know, the people even randomly would start to come just to hear their story time at the end of the day, you know, during dinner time. Some of the muleteers started to get saved. So God was starting to do a really neat work here. And the people of Yangcheng started to accept the women. They started to realize, okay, they actually care about us. They're here for, you know, a good reason, and they're not hurting our people. They actually love us. And so, you know, it basically just took time. And a lot of times, that's what we don't find out because we get impatient and we bail out, or we just are like, okay, I'm through with this. I'm just not going to finish it out, or I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to go on anymore. When if we really would just be patient and wait it out, you know, God might want to do something that we didn't expect. My dad always says, he always says, let it play out, you know, and because I can be impatient and be like, I'm going to just do all this other stuff. And he's like, just let it play out and see what happens. And so often that's the case. If you let things play out for a while, then eventually, you know, it starts to work out all right. And that was exactly what happened. They just had to be patient, be in the village for a long time, do what they could to reach out to the people, and God began to open doors for them. So Gladys spent a lot of time trying to learn Chinese, and Yang helped her a lot with this because she wanted to be able to, you know, partake of the Bible reading, you know. I mean, that was part of why she was there. The main reason she was there, to share the gospel. And so she wanted to kind of give Jeannie a break now and then. Remember, Jeannie's getting up there, right? She's in her 70s and everything. She's like, you know, I'll give you a break. I'll tell the Bible story tonight now that my Chinese is starting to improve a little bit. And Yang tried to tell the Bible story sometimes too, but he was a little confused because he wasn't saved yet. So here's what they found out. I love this story. On two occasions, they discovered Yang describing enthusiastically how Jesus Christ put all the animals on the ark and sailed to safety across the floodwaters to Bethlehem. So he would kind of mix his stories up a lot. Another time, I like this one, Gladys listened to the evening storytelling, and she discovered without much surprise that it was Noah who fed the loaves and fish to the 5,000 as he was sailing past the coast of Galilee in the ark. So Yang loved the ark, and he brought the ark into every story. So he just found a way, like, let's see, what can I do to bring the boat in here, you know? So that was what really spoke to his heart. Maybe that's how he got saved eventually. I don't know. But anyway, so things were going along. All was well, except the fact that Yang was a heretic. But other than that, they carried on, and everything was fine. And then one day, Jeannie and Gladys got in like this really minor little argument about something, but I don't know. I think that it was just for whatever reason, it kind of escalated very quickly. They got in a huff. I know, women, right? Can't they just communicate? Gosh. So anyways, they both decided they needed a break from each other. So they went, you know, Jeannie went off to this other village. I can't remember what Gladys did, but Jeannie goes off to kind of cool down for a few days. So she's Scottish, you know. They're a little fiery. I can say that. My brother-in-law's Scottish, so I know. This is empty. That's helpful. Is there any water? Dang it. Okay. We're almost to the break. So Jeannie goes off, and she's staying at this place. Unfortunately, she was walking up on the second floor balcony, and she fell off. I think it was just like the railing wasn't safe, and she leaned over and fell over the railing. And since, Corey, jeez, I know, it's like, so, she was raised from the dead by Yang. No, I'm just kidding. That didn't happen. So anyway, but remember, people are afraid. Okay, remember, she's in a different village. So the people are afraid of this white-haired woman, like, oh, she's an evil spirit. So nobody went near her. She's lying there like, you know. Like all paralyzed or something. I can't remember what happened. She had internal injuries. She couldn't really move. So she's laying there. Nobody's helping her. Finally, word gets to Gladys that, you know, Jeannie's lying here, half conscious, and nobody will go and take care of her. And she ran to her. But by this time, unfortunately, Jeannie was dying. I know. So, well, the good thing was they got reconciled at least. They were able to make up their differences. I think at that point, you'd probably sweep it all under the rug. Like, I'm still holding this over you, even if you're dying. No, I mean, so anyways, they made up and everything. They were able to spend that last time together. And then it was too late to save Jeannie's life, so she died November of 1933, leaving Gladys and Yang to run the inn by themselves. And so in spite of their differences, you know, and they had, you know, had a lot. They had the age difference. They had the Scottish-English thing going on, you know, which some of you know that can be a real serious thing, right? And especially if, well, good thing that Jeannie wasn't Irish. It would have really gotten out of hand. So they're like crazy. My friend once told me, she said at her church when she was growing up in Ireland that one day they were talking about forgiveness, and at the end of the service, they all had to put their hands towards England and forgive England for all that they had done or something. It was kind of, so this is like, this runs deep, okay, in these countries. Britain's kind of gnarly. So anyway, that was so completely unrelated. But Gladys learned a lot from Jeannie, all right? One of those things was probably how to make haggis. Also, the power, you guys don't even know what that is, right? Okay, sorry, dumb joke. No, haggis is so Scottish. Are you kidding? All right. So she learned the power of prayer from Jeannie, all right? And so that was something she really needed at a time like this. She's like, if there's one thing I've learned from Jeannie Lawson, I need to, you know, stay at it, and I need to really pray through this season. So not knowing what to do at this point, and this was hard. Gladys had only been there, what, like a year, a little over a year? Yeah, a year. And so she's like, you know, suddenly thrust into this thing all by herself. And so she just kept praying, you know, again, very simple. But what do I do? I don't know what else to do. I'll just keep running the inn. I do know how to do that. This is what we've been doing. We'll keep it going. But she realized that without the support that Jeannie had contributed, because they both kind of threw their, you know, whatever money they had in the pool together. But she knew she would need at this point more income in order to survive. But here she is, again, a random white woman in the middle of inland China. How is she going to earn money? What is she going to do? You know, there's not a McDonald's to go work at or something. So God provided his answer in his own way. And, you know, as Isaiah 55 said, his ways are not our ways and his thoughts are not our thoughts. And I'm sure we all have a testimony to that effect of how the Lord has worked in some random way that we were not expecting. And so when he calls, he's going to provide. And that is exactly what he did for her. So here's what happened. We'll do this part and then, yeah, we'll take a break. Are we okay?
Yeah.
Oh, this is a good story, right? You don't want to stop now. So a few weeks after Jeannie died, Yang mentioned something about Gladys paying her respects to the Mandarin. The Mandarin was the local governor, okay? Also a kind of orange. So the Mandarin was the governor of Yangcheng, and he also kind of was like, you know, he had influence in the whole surrounding region, okay? And so he was a very powerful figure, and so Gladys was not looking forward to this. I mean, there was no protocol for foreign women visiting Chinese dignitaries, and so she didn't really know, like, how am I supposed to do this, and what am I supposed to say? She was just trying to avoid it at all costs, and Yang kept telling her, you need to go meet Mandarin and all this stuff, and she's like, nah, trying to put it off. Well, she didn't have to ponder it for too long because the Mandarin himself came to the inn one day. And so, I mean, she had no choice at that point. She's like, great, now he's here, and I have, you know, I have to talk to him. He's just right there. So he told her that he needed her, you know, obviously he knew about her. Everybody knew about the foreign devils, right, living in their town. And so he said that he needed her to enforce a new law against the practice of foot binding, which was so prevalent in China. I actually had a picture of this somewhere. I'll find it during the break. While we're watching the UCLA-Florida basketball game, I'll look for that. So that's important, you guys. It's on right now. Anyway, for those of you who are into March Madness.
Gonzaga's out.
I know. Gonzaga's out. That made me sad, too. Moment of silence. Okay, so the history of foot binding is actually kind of interesting. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this at all, but apparently centuries and centuries ago, long ago and far, far away, one of the emperor's wives had run away. And so it was thought that if they would have bound her feet up, she wouldn't have been able to run so fast and they would have been able to, you know, take her out, all right, or something. So she wouldn't have been able to run so fast. So it was decreed from that point on that all women's feet needed to be bound in order to keep them in line, because you never know when your wife was going to run away from you. So basically what they would do is when girls were first born, they would curl up their toes. This makes my feet cramp just reading this. Okay. So they would curl their toes up under their feet when they were little babies and then bind it all together so that they would stay small their whole lives. So you've got your foot like just completely curled under and bound like this. So even though your foot is growing all your life, your toes are continuing to grow underneath. And so you basically just kind of hobbled around like this, you know. So, you know, in the old days, they used to picture Chinese women walking like this. And that's why, because that's what they had to do. They kind of had to hobble along. So really horrible, horrible practice. But it was ancient. It had been going on for so many centuries. It was just accepted without any question. But it was also very inhumane. It was painful. It was very cruel. And so with the coming of more advanced thinking government officials, more modernized thinking, laws were being decreed that foot binding needed to stop. And that was pretty easy to enforce, like in some of the more modern cities, you know, Shanghai, all those towns on the coast. It wasn't really that big a deal because they were used to Westerners. They'd seen people with big feet, you know, right? Their feet unbound and everything. So they knew what that looked like, and it wasn't a big deal. So most of the coastal regions had already adapted to this and were doing fine. But remember, we're in inland China, right, where they don't really see a lot of outside action or anything. They're used to the old ways. This is the way we've done it for centuries, and they didn't want to change, right? They loved their tradition. They didn't want to see anything change like that. And even some of that, you know, especially like the husbands and the men in the families, they were, you know, for whatever reason, superstitious and afraid that, oh, if we, you know, unbind the women's feet, they're all going to run away from us. But the Mandarin was, again, he was one of these government officials who recognized his responsibility that he needed to do something about this. And so he came to Gladys and he said, I need you to find a woman with big feet like you, with unbound feet, to come and you know, perform this job. And he said, it's not very high paying. You'll have to ride a mule to all the surrounding villages, but it's a very important job. So you need to find somebody who can do this. So Gladys searched for 2 months trying to find somebody. And of course, I mean, who is she going to find? She's like the only one there that, you know, has big feet or unbound feet, right? So she didn't really have a lot of success looking around, even into the surrounding villages and everything. So the Mandarin comes back to her 2 months later. He's like, okay, who do you have for me? And Gladys kind of sheepishly was like, well, I didn't find anybody. I'm sorry. And so he said, well, I guess that means it's a job for you. You get to do it. Congratulations. And so Gladys was horrified. This was the last thing she wanted to do because she came to China. She came to China to share Jesus with the people, not to become a government official. She's like, this is so not my, you know, what my MO. This is not what I'm going to do. But as he continued to talk to her, the light bulb went on, and she realized, wait a minute, this is a huge opportunity to share the gospel in all of these villages. If I go and inspect feet, I can go and tell them about Jesus in all of these different towns. I mean, and that was her and Jeannie's original vision, right, for the mule trains, was to give the gospel to people so that they could go to the surrounding areas. And so she thought, man, maybe this is God's really crazy, unexpected way of bringing that to pass. Which it was, again, right? His ways are not his ways. His thoughts are not our thoughts. And this was definitely the farthest thing from her mind. But it was what God was opening up for her. So she told the Mandarin, she said, you must realize, Excellency, that if I accept this position, I shall try to convert the people of the province to Christianity wherever I go. I just want you to know, I'm going to lay it all out there. I'm going to share the gospel everywhere I go. Are you okay with that? And he was like, I don't care what you do. I just want you to unbind all these feet. You know, I'm getting pressure from the guys down in Shanghai. And, you know, I just need you to just do your job. And he said he would even send soldiers with her. So she'd have a military escort for protection everywhere she went. I mean, she was just set for life, basically. So these doors just all opened very naturally. And again, she wasn't looking for this. You know, she wasn't trying to come up with some idea like, what's some crazy way I can share the gospel with people? God just opened the doors and she simply walked through them. So this was what she continued to do for the next several, you know, the next several years. Oh, this is a good story. We'll get to this in a minute. Let's take a break first, okay? So hold that thought. All right, here we go. You better get that fixed quick. I just had my tune-up today, so I highly recommend that. Mm-hmm. Car. All right. All right. Labrador. Ooh, wow, you found the hardcore one. Oh, fun. Oh, that's awesome. I'm glad you're enjoying it. All right, peeps, let's focus in. Ready? Oh, you know you're ready. You guys were born ready. Okay, here we go. Part dos. I don't actually know where I am. I get all that great intro. Oh, okay. So, she does the... Okay, so the foot binding thing. So here we go. All right. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, She continued serving in this for a while, like I said, and then they started a Chinese church started to grow in the area. People were giving their lives to the Lord. There was a young convert from Seichao, the nearby town, that missionaries sent to help Gladys with the work. They also had a lot of corrections to make on Yang's storytelling, so, you know, they had to kind of, there's a lot they needed to deal with there, so they kind of tag-teamed it and, you know, shared together in the ministry at the inn. And then during around that same time, in the midst of her second, you know, third year there in China, and this had all happened within the first couple of years, right? So now she's out, like, foot inspecting and going through all the villages and stuff and coming back to the inn and working. And then during that same time, another kind of crazy thing happened, which helped her connect with the Chinese even more and gain further, gain their respect even more. Or as they would say, gain much face. That's how they, you know, she gained face among them because of what happened. So what happened was there was a riot in the local prison. And so Gladys was summoned by the Mandarin to go and deal with it. You know, apparently now he just felt like she was at his beck and call and she would just go do whatever he said. Like, well, you're a foot inspector. Why don't you go deal with this prison riot? Right. So she gets there and she realizes, okay, this isn't just like a little riot where the guys are like unfair treatment, walking around with sandwich boards and stuff like that. I mean, this was like gnarly. This was like, you know, there's like murder going on here. She goes up to the, you know, near the prison yard. She can't see into the prison yard outside there, but she can hear all this screaming and shouting coming from there. And the governor of the prison comes up to her and he says, oh my gosh, there's like, you know, everybody's like in there killing each other. Like literally the prisoners were all killing each other. And there's, you know, I mean, these are prisoners. There's like murderers in there already, right? So this is nothing for them. It's like, might as well kill someone else. I'm already here, you know. Bandits, thieves, all kinds of crooks in there. They're all, again, they're going on this mass murder spree, and there weren't enough soldiers to stop them. And it didn't even matter if there were enough soldiers because the soldiers themselves were too scared to go in the prison anymore. I think they had probably gone and tried to, like, calm things down, but when that didn't work, they all just left. And so Gladys is like, okay, what am I supposed to do about this? Seriously? I'll foot binding's one thing, but, you know, this is kind of a little bit out of my league. And the governor just said to her, well, the Mandarin sent for you because you're going to go in and stop it, right? She's like, right. So obviously Gladys refused because, you know, it's pretty obvious if the soldiers don't want to be in there, why would I want to go in there? I'm like 5 feet tall and, you know, probably not a lot of muscle tone. I mean, I don't know. I shouldn't say that just by looking at that. But, you know, she's not like this little tough cookie, right? She's just a little maid. And so she wasn't going to go in there and power her way through the prison. So she's like, there's no way I'm going in there. This isn't going to happen. But I love what the prison governor said to her, the prison guard. He said, how can they kill you? You tell everybody that you have come here because you have the living God inside of you. You preach it everywhere, in the streets and in the villages. If you preach the truth, if your God's protecting you from harm, then you can go stop the riot. So I love this. Okay, we talk about how simple Gladys was. So was this guy. He's just like, well, hey, you have God inside of you. Isn't that enough? I mean, come on. We don't have that going on for us. You go in and take care of it, lady. You can do this. And so I love it. It reminds me of like the people in the Gospels and the way they were with Jesus, right? Just that simple childlike faith, like the centurion, right? You know, speak the word and my servant will be healed. You know, that's all you need to do, Lord. I mean, they just took Jesus at face value. Like, you have power, you can heal. Just go ahead and do it. They didn't sit there and ask, well, do you want to do it right now? Or is this the wrong timing, Lord? Or maybe I should be praying for something else. Maybe I shouldn't want this. You know, we go and analyze all of these things instead of just being like, God, if you're God, you can do anything. So why not? You know, and that's what this guy was coming at her with, was just the simplicity of the truth. The fact that she did have the living God inside of her and that he could do anything. So Gladys realized that this guy was right. She's like, man, if I don't act now, then all that I've been proclaiming out here throughout, you know, inland China means nothing. I might as well just quit and go home if I'm not going to act on my faith right now in this instance. And so really the question was, you know, how big was her God in her eyes? You know, how big was God? Was he able? Was he, you know, could he do this for her? Do the miraculous? Do the impossible? And so, good question. She found herself in a corner here. And I think, really, it's probably a good place for all of us to come to in our walk with the Lord. It's a scary place to be in when you're at those kind of crossroads where you have to just take a step and believe and just bank everything on the Lord and throw everything on him and be like, okay, God, I'm going to take you at your word and trust you. It's not always easy, but it's a really good place for us to be in our walk with him. And you know, I'm sure some of us have already been in those kind of positions. And, you know, hopefully we all will be at some point where we just have to simply step out and just go for it because we have no alternative. You know, because that's when God wants to come in and show himself strong, right? And get himself great glory is when we have no alternative but to trust him and to just throw it all back on him. And so, in spite of her extreme fear, Gladys said she would go in the prison, confident just in the fact that she knew her God. She's like, I know God, and I'm going in his name, right? That's all she knew. I'm going in the name of the Lord. I'm going to go in with the God that I've been preaching everywhere. But that was more than enough, right? That was more than enough. Remember, right? The people who know their God will be... Come on, guys. It's only been an hour since I asked you that. Okay, the people who know their God will be strong and... Great exploits. Okay, oh my gosh, don't sound too excited about this. It's only the word of God, people. I mean, come on. Anyways, so, yes, the people who know their God will be strong and carry out great exploits. So that's what she's going to do, right? Because she knew her God. And if she didn't know God, there's no way she would have ever gone in there. She'd peace out and go back home, right? Back on that train through Russia. So, so she goes in. She's like, okay. So she walks into the prison and... I mean, the sight that greeted her, she walks in there, she was just like, you got to be kidding me, okay? Because all she had heard at this point was the screaming, like, ah, you know, just blood-curdling screams, which could mean anything. But she didn't expect to walk in and see, like, this bloodbath. But there was just blood, like, all over the place. All of these injured men lying all over the prison yard. A couple of them were lying dead in a pool of blood nearby. And so she walks in, I mean, and that's the first thing she sees is just like blood and bodies all over the place. And then as she's watching everybody run around, because it's just mass chaos in there and everybody's running around, and she kind of figured out that the center of the chaos was this man wielding an axe. This guy had an axe, and he's like running around, like chasing everybody and just chopping people up and stuff with this axe. So I know this is like some really like campy horror movie. Anyway, so... But with this, so he had this nutty, you know, just crazy, I don't know, I guess it was just I would think it must have been some kind of demonic possession kind of a thing almost, because he was just running around chasing all the other prisoners. So trying not to pass out, Gladys kind of stepped into the prison yard a little bit further, away from the wall, and the man saw her, you know, he saw the movement, he looked over, he sees her, and he's like, ah, and he starts running towards her with the axe. All right. And this is just so hard to picture. I'm like, how in the world? Anyways, so he's coming at her with the axe and obviously not knowing what to do. Gladys looked at him. She just looked him full in the face and she said, give me the axe, as he's coming up to her. And guess what? He did. Yeah. He's like, and he just handed it to her. Dude, crazy. I know. So he's like, this little thing? Sure. You know, so he gives her the axe and it's just like, okay, you know, now what does she do? So she's got the axe out of the guy's hand. He's all, you know, sorry about that. I don't know what came over me. It got kind of crazy in here. I didn't, you know, anyways. So I don't know what he did. I don't know if he actually did that, but.
At this point, was she pretty fluent in the native language?
Yeah. I think she was getting, well, I would assume so. She knew enough to say, like, give me the axe. I mean, that's all you need to say in a moment like that. What?
Was it just like in the
30s, 40s
style?
Yeah. This is only like 1934, maybe? 34, 35? And they did have axes in the 1930s, if that's what you're wondering. I'm just kidding. I know, well, you'd think, but... Well, it wasn't like a stone axe. I mean, they weren't running around in loincloths. I mean, they were, you know, they were civilized. Yeah, it wasn't like that. They just had a, yeah. No, I know. Oh, because he had an axe and not like a knife or a gun? Oh, okay. Anyway, I don't know. He just, yeah, for whatever reason, he had an axe. Maybe somebody was... That is the question. Yeah, maybe, who knows? I mean, maybe one of the prison guards had left it in there at a more, you know.
Did you hear Corey?
They sent the kid. Yeah, exactly. That's a good point, Corey. Okay. Yeah. Well, what good's a file going to do, right? This is like a wood prison or something like that. So we'll send in an axe. You can chop your way through. So anyways, for whatever reason... So he gives her the axe, and he's just, like, all apologetic, and, gosh, lady, please don't, you know, let's just forget this whole thing happened, you know? So, yeah, right, as there's, like, dead people lying behind him. So, anyways, I'm not, you know, she didn't really know what to do. Okay, so she's got the axe. It's like, okay, now what? Now what do I do? And so, but again, you know, Gladys, she's just kind of carrying on very simply here. And so she just took charge and she said, okay, here's what we're going to do. I want, you know, let's clean this place up. Let's get all the wounded people over here and the dead people over here. I guess we got to tidy up around here. I'm a maid. This is a mess. So I want all the dead guys over on this side. And I mean, anyways, no, really, that's kind of what they ended up doing was, I mean, I'm probably making it silly, but yeah, so they kind of gather everybody up into little piles and groups. So it looked much more tidy now. And she said, and then I want you guys to form in lines and appoint somebody to tell me what this is all about. So she just took charge, man. Little take charge woman here. She comes in and just tells them, and they all obeyed her. They're like, oh, okay. So they go and clean up. Is this okay? How's this? Is it, you know, I mean, and then they come and I know they all line up in rows and they're just staring at her like, okay, what do we do now? You know, so really bizarre. Anyway, so he all comes out. This guy comes up and he's like, well, here's the deal. You know, let's talk about our feelings and what happened. And so apparently the men had no food for one thing. That would make anyone go nuts, right? I mean, you might start carrying an axe around yourself if you didn't have food for a long time. So they didn't have any food unless their families brought them something. And a lot of these guys didn't have families, you know, that they came from. You know, some of them didn't have anyone to care for them. And so they're just kind of there on their own with nothing to do but sit around all day and just go nuts. So Gladys is like, okay, I'll take care of it. So she leaves the prison, and the prison governor's like, oh, my gosh, you're amazing. Anything you want, whatever needs to happen. And so she said, okay, here's what you need to do. You need to provide some kind of work that these guys can do from prison so that they can earn money to buy food. And also you need to bring in some weaving looms and teach them how to sew, make clothes for themselves or something like that. So I was like, well, that's a random thing, but okay. So they needed that. They needed clothing. They needed food. And so she's like, let's take care of their practical needs. That's what you need to do at this point. And you probably won't have any more like axe, you know, murderers going on in here. So the governor obviously agreed. And so now here's Gladys Aylward. She's a innkeeper, a foot inspector, and now she's a prison reformer. Okay. And this all just got thrown on her out of left field. So she actually continued to go and assist and visit the prisoners. She even got permission from the governor for all of them to come to church one Sunday with her, which I thought was pretty cute. You know, they all traipse into church and sit there, you know, obediently. They loved her. It's just so crazy. Anyway, so they did everything she said, you know, jump, and they said how high. So I know. I like that, too. So I love this story because, again, it was all these simple ways that the Lord just kept opening these huge doors of ministry and opportunity for her because she never sought any of this out. Like, yeah, who would? I think I'll go and, you know, stop a prison riot today. That sounds fun. So she was never sought any of these things out. She just goes to China, ends up running an inn with this little old lady, meeting all the needs that arose, and God just continued to open doors. All she had to do was simply walk through them as God opened them for her. She wasn't banging down the door and trying to make things happen on her own. The Lord just did this. And she just had to be obedient. And he did the rest. And this gave her even greater closeness to the people than ever before. In fact, after this incident, the prison governor called Gladys Awade. Okay, so that's her nickname there. Awade. And when she asked Yang what that meant, he said, oh, that means virtuous one. And so she liked that, right? That's pretty nice. Aylward was too hard for the Chinese people to say for whatever reason. And so she needed a Chinese name anyway. So she's like, oh, I'll go by Gladys Awade. Why not? They, you know, they can understand that. And so this was a huge honor for them to esteem her this way. She became known everywhere as Awade from this point on. So another thing that happened around this time, Gladys noticed often when she was out and about on her foot inspecting rounds, that there were these women who would be selling children on the side of the road, okay? So it's like, yeah, kind of human trafficking-ish kind of thing going on here. So one day, she went to the Mandarin to make her latest foot inspecting report and tell her about all, you know, tell him about all the villages. What? There we go. Yeah. Very good. And so so she goes to make her foot inspection report. And she took the opportunity to kind of complain to him about it. Like, what are you going to do about these child sellers on the side of the road? This is terrible. And he just ordered her to give her report. And then he said, you know what, Gladys, ignore the child dealers. Don't worry about them. That's just part of our culture. And Gladys was super disappointed by this because she really had grown to appreciate and respect the Mandarin. They were starting to form a friendship here. And so her biographer said this, that as she was leaving, she turned around one last time and she said to him, I have to inform you that I did not come to China just to observe your laws. I came for the love of Jesus Christ, and I shall act upon the principles of his teaching no matter what you say. It was a well-timed exit. Before the surprised Mandarin had time to reply, she was gone. So she just turned and bailed. And he's like, ah, you know, so he was didn't have anything to say to that. Months later, when she was on terms of greater friendship, this is intimacy, but it wasn't like that. he told her that his friendship and his respect for her had stemmed from that action. It was the first time in his term of office that any person, man or woman, had dared question his authority as the Mandarin, and it was certainly the first time in his life that any woman had spoken to him in such a fashion. And so, I mean, that really, like, stunned him. He, you know, and made a really strong impression on him, as we're going to see later on. So, Gladys went out, you know, in a huff, went to the nearest child dealer that she saw on the side of the road, and offered whatever money she had in order to buy the little kid, the little girl. And the amount of money that she gave amounted to about 9 pence in British money. And so she bought the child. Again, it was a little girl, and she nicknamed her 9 pence. So that was her name, because that's what she paid for. So she called her 9 pence. Very creative woman, Gladys Aylward. So eventually, this little girl became basically her adopted daughter. And that's not her, in case you're wondering. I mean, Gladys was a lot younger when she had 9 pence. Actually, that's a little boy anyway, so it doesn't matter. Moving on. She also, and then it was sweet because 9 pence actually helped to expand the little family. What happened was one night at dinner, 9 pence came in and asked Gladys, she said, "If I was willing to eat a little less of this meal, would you be willing to eat a little less also?" And Gladys was like, "Yeah, okay, I could do that. I could eat a little less." And then 9 pence said, "Okay, if we put our 2 lesses into a basin, we'd have enough food for one more person, right?" And Gladys is like, "Okay, what are you up to, 9 pence?" And so 9 pence pointed to a little boy that was standing outside in the courtyard and asked if he could come in. And so, of course, Gladys said, "Okay." And so the boy came in, and pretty soon, you know, he became part of the family, and they nicknamed him Les. So, anyway, because of the way that, never mind. So, moving on. So this is how Gladys became kind of a mother to all of these little orphans. She started just taking in all kinds of kids from that point on. So this was a really sweet time, these early years for her. She continued to travel throughout the villages, sharing Jesus. In fact, her biographer said, and I think this is really sweet, "Even today, if one walked through some of those isolated villages, the songs that the men and women would be singing as they worked in the fields would be Christian hymns." Isn't that neat? So, I mean, it just spread. Even the little songs that she taught the people, you know, they were spreading all over the countryside. And so the influence of the gospel was going out. In 1936, Gladys decided to become a Chinese citizen so that she would be able to identify even further with the people in their lives. And so she said, "It was better to be a Chinese foreigner than a foreign devil." She's like, "At least I've upgraded a little bit here by becoming a Chinese foreigner." So things were going well. And then, bum, 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 here we go again. World War II broke out. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So, well, yes, Corey, funny you should mention that. So with the coming of World War II, Japanese air raid invasions started to happen in their area. And when they struck Yangcheng, the poor peasants there, they were completely taken off guard. Remember, these are country people who live out in the mountains, right? They don't, you know, they don't see a lot of technology out here in the hills. They're just got their mules and, you know, all their little animals out in the field and stuff. So they start seeing the airplanes flying over, and they just think that they're big silver birds. They're like, "Whoa, look at that." And so they all go running out to see what the silver birds are doing. And then the silver birds start dropping these big metal cylinders, and they're like, "Oh, what is that?" Well, they probably thought it was going to the bathroom, but, you know, they just really didn't know what that was. They're like, "Oh, okay." So they're all basically running out into harm's way as these bombs are falling from the sky, and so all the villagers are getting killed. Yeah, this was going on all over inland China. The Japanese were just coming in and starting to bomb all these areas. And so Gladys and a lot of other Chinese, a lot of the other people were buried in the rubble after the first bombing. But once they got freed from that, Gladys and some of the city leaders immediately got to work on relief efforts, as well as preparing to evacuate the village. And remember, Gladys is from England, right? She's from London. So she knows about war, right? She had lived through World War I in London. So she understood something about, you know, what to do in wartime and how to handle this kind of a situation. So she, you know, kept a clear head throughout the whole thing. In fact, within 5 days, she got everybody including her little 40-member Christian community, evacuated to this little mountain village called Beichai Shuang, which became kind of like their little base for a season. So by the time the Japanese troops arrived in Yangcheng, it was empty. So, I mean, it was great, the mobilization effort. Like, again, Gladys knew what to do because she's like, dude, you know, we've been through war before over in Europe. We'll take care of I'll take care of this. So she got them all mobilized and everybody got out okay. So everybody was now safe, but a week later, a lot of the people were told to go back to the villages. Sadly, not everybody went. A few people did, though. And unfortunately, those who did return got caught in the middle of crossfire. They got caught in like a battle between the Chinese and Japanese. And so a whole bunch of villagers ended up getting gunned down by the Japanese. And interestingly, when they had been told they should go back to the village, Gladys kind of had this check in her spirit, like she shouldn't go. You know, she just had this sense that the Lord was like, uh-uh, don't go back yet. And so when she finally did, after some time, she realized why. Because, you know, the Japanese had come through and, like, just, you know, massacred all the villagers that came back. And unfortunately, by the time she showed up, it was too late. There was nothing but dead bodies all over the village when she went in. And so it was said, quote, "The west gate was open. They walked slowly under the arch, every step confirming her intuition. It was a city of the dead. A city of hollowed-eyed corpses piled along the main street and in every alleyway. Most of them had been bayoneted. Very few were shot." So that's pretty brutal. That means basically they just went in and stabbed everybody, you know. So all along the streets, in the temples, in the bazaars, the bodies crouched or lay, some twisted grotesquely, others with a foot or a hand stretched into the air, even women and children. So everyone had been, like, you know, taken down, basically. And the brutality of the Japanese during World War II really astounded Gladys. She couldn't believe how, just how cruel they were. You know, I mean, war is one thing, but they were taking it to another level a little bit here. Over the next few weeks, the Japanese planes would randomly pass over the mountains and the fields, and they would just shoot whenever they felt like it. If they saw, like, little peasants working out in the fields, they would just gun them down for no reason. And it's not like there was a factory nearby or these were, you know what I mean? They were, like, in strategic locations. I mean, these are just villagers out in the fields. They're farmers. Yeah, they're just farmers. It was just cruel. It was just unnecessary. And so, yeah, and they had no weapons. Obviously, they had nothing. And so it was just an opportunity for them to, you know, kill Chinese people. So Gladys returned to Beichai Shuang, and then she started to make a kind of a makeshift hospital to try to, you know, she just did whatever she could to help everyone survive, because these were getting into really dark days as we get into 1939 with, you know, and that's when everything really got going, 1939, 1940. As I'm sure many of you know. But that spring, later on that spring, the people tried actually going back to the villages again. And you read the story, and they just kept trying to go back into their village. They wanted to get back to normal life. But the army is like, no, you can't do that, guys. You're still at war. You're going to, you know, you're risking your lives. And so what the Chinese army told the people that they needed to do was stop going back to the villages. Instead, We're going to start instituting scorched earth policy. Basically, you just burn everything and then just move further and further up into the hills, go further and further north. That way, the Japanese, whenever they come into a town, they won't get anything out of it because everything will be all burned up. Okay? And that's something that's been practiced in war before. The most famous example would be the Russians during Napoleon's invasion, right? Napoleon invades and they just kept moving further and further up, further north, until finally Napoleon's armies all died in the Russian winter, right? So you Russians are so smart. Anyway, they started it all, and everybody just took it from there. So we got to give them props. So Gladys was in Yangcheng at the time. She actually went back to the village for a little bit. And before their final evacuation, because they all knew, like, okay, you can go back to the village briefly and get whatever you need there, but then you need to burn the village and just move on. And so before their final evacuation, the Mandarin told her he had something important to announce, and so he invited her to a final feast. And Gladys had gone to these occasions, you know, to these events before, so she's like, okay, I'll come. So she gets there, and when she went, she was surprised to find that she was being seated as the guest of honor up near the Mandarin. And she's like, wow, this is weird. I've never had that happen before. So she goes, and she's seated there. She was used to being the only woman present, but this was something kind of random. Until the Mandarin got up and explained, and he said, you know, I've been watching Gladys, and I've come to know her for several years now, and I just realized that what she has is genuine, and I've decided that I want to become a Christian. And so he announced it there at the party, or at the feast, or meal, or whatever. And so, I know, I thought that was so sweet. And so he becomes a believer right then and there. And I love that. You know, he had just been watching her life, her consistent life with the Lord. You know, she just preached Jesus and lived for Jesus everywhere she went. And remember that one time when she had told him, like, you know, this is why I came here, was for the love of Jesus, regardless of what you say about the child dealers. From that moment, that was when he really started to, you know, pay attention to what she had to say and realize that there was something really powerful there in her life that he didn't have. And so he became a believer. Pretty awesome. And then they finished the meal and everything. And then it was time to start getting back to brass tacks. You know, we got to get into the practical stuff here. Let's talk about the evacuation. The hardest thing with the evacuation was what to do with all the prisoners. Because apparently they'd been dragging the prisoners all over the countryside, all chained together and everything. It was just so impractical. It's like, this isn't, you know, we're just a sitting duck here waiting for the Japanese to come and find us. You know, we've got all of these guys. And so they basically sent a lot of them back to their families. But remember, there were prisoners who didn't have a family. So guess who they went with? They went with Gladys, right? So Gladys takes all the little prisoners. Okay, come on, guys. Okay, you know, and they, you know. Again, they would follow her to the ends of the earth. They respected her completely. They gave her no trouble. For the next several months, they just hung out with her. So there's loads of stories about all this. I mean, they were wandering over the mountains for months, ministering to the sick and the wounded. And this is when Gladys's reputation really began to spread even farther as the virtuous one, Awade. And people knew, you know, not only that she was a virtuous woman, but that more than anything, that she had a very powerful God. And she saw God do a lot of really amazing things during that time. So, but you'll just have to read the book yourself to find out what those amazing things were. So, late in 1939, the Japanese were retreating a little bit. And so everybody once again tried to go back to their villages. But instead of going to Yangcheng, Gladys ended up in Seychelles, the nearest village, the other village kind of nearby, because there were some missionaries there who had to make a trip to the coast. And so she said, I'll come to Seychelles. I'll hold the fort down for you. And so she ended up holding church services and running a mission. Turned out they had about 100 kids staying at this mission there in Seychelles. And so she kind of ran the whole facility. Around this time, she met a man named Lin Nan. Who was a very important Chinese nationalist officer. And he came to her with a proposition. He said, okay, I need your help against the Japanese because you are so well known among the Chinese. You know all of the mountain trails and all the mountain villages, but you're also just this little insignificant woman. So the Japanese won't, you know, they would not know anything about you. So here's what I want you to do. I want to see if you would be willing to go and maneuver behind enemy lines and spy for the Chinese government. So Gladys professed neutrality, you know, because she's like, I'm a Christian. I don't want to take sides and all of this. She didn't, you know, have like this, you know, raging patriotism for China or something like that. But she agreed to take on yet another new job title. So here we have Gladys Aylward, innkeeper, foot inspector, prison reformer, refugee coordinator, and now she's a military spy. So dun, dun, dun. Woo-hoo, the plot thickens. So, I know, cue the Mission Impossible music or something like that. Obviously, very dangerous job. At one point, Gladys and a group of Chinese refugees had to live in a cave for 6 weeks. But her spying was really, really helpful for the Chinese army well into 1940. So she spent most of the next year spying and leaking information to them and everything. Not only that, but her relationship with this guy, Lin Nan, started to grow a little bit, you know. So they weren't just friends after a little while. There's something else going on here. Although, this is wartime, and we're not going to make any commitments. It's a war. There's a war going on. So they, you know, they kind of kept it, on, you know, very much on the DL. But not like Hudson Taylor on the DL, who was going and trying to, like, make out with that girl all the time secretly. He wasn't like that, okay? This was very much like, you know, very proper, and she just said, this is war, we're not going to do this. So, I know that made it sound really bad about Hudson Taylor. Sorry, you guys know what I'm talking about, right? Okay. I just meant, you know, they were kissing love and all that, so, which was very improper for the Victorians. So, now, she's traveling all over the countryside. Gladys eventually ended up back in Seychelles. fully realizing the Japanese were always going to be trying to come back and take these particular towns. Yangcheng and Seichao, for whatever reason, they were strategically located. And so the Japanese were constantly coming back and trying to claim these towns. But she just determined that she was not going to leave. I'm going to hold my ground here. I'm not going to let them come in and take us. But she was concerned because, remember, there was that mission with 100 kids living there. And so she started to worry about the kids. Like, it's fine for me to stay here and be tough, but I can't force the kids to stay if the Japanese come through. I don't want them to get killed. And so she just had this, again, this sense from the Lord that she needed to do something for these kids. And she started to have this sense of urgency. And this was something the Lord had really, if you read the story, you see that she just always had this sense from the Lord when she should move, when she should stay. There was a sense of urgency when she needed to act. And, you know, it's just the Holy Spirit working in her as she carried along, you know, and she just obeyed that prompting. And so she started to have that sense of urgency for the sake of the children at this point. So it just so happened that news reached her that Madam Chiang Kai-shek had started a war orphanage way across the country. And so Gladys connected with them and arranged to have 100 kids brought by a Christian man over the mountains to the orphanage. So she arranged for, I would think, most of the kids from that orphanage in Seichao to go all the way to the war haven. So, but again, remember, Gladys wanted to stick it out. She was tough. She's like, I'm not going anywhere. You know, her motto was Christians never retreat. And so I'm in this for the long haul. Even, you know, she's very stubborn that way. So she's planning on staying there, but at this point, she was told by the Chinese military that she had to leave immediately. They're like, Gladys, we know it's very admirable that you want to stay in Seichao and hold down the fort here, but you really need to go because we just found out there's a price on your head. The Japanese figured out who you are, and now you're like wanted. She was like one of those people on a wanted poster now. Apparently, all her spying had been found out, and so they even showed her a flyer that said, $100 reward will be paid by the Japanese army for information leading to the capture alive of either of the three people listed below. And one of them was the Mandarin, and the other one was the small woman known as Awade. So there's like a bounty out on her now. And so that kind of settled it for her. She's like, okay, I guess I better, you know, time to swallow my pride and my stubbornness and just submit. And so it wasn't what she wanted to do. But even her Bible reading that day confirmed that she should go. And I thought that was kind of neat. She still waited to hear from the Lord. She just still wanted to have that confirmation, even though this is what people were telling her to do. She wanted to hear what God had to say. And she read a verse that said, flee to the mountains, dwell in the hidden places, because of the king of Babylon has conceived a purpose against you. And so she's like, okay, flee. That's what I'm supposed to do. So again, in simplicity, when God spoke, she obeyed. And she happened to round up another 100 kids from somewhere, and took them with her over the mountains to the war haven. So this is another thing she does. So she like launches out on this, I'm thinking of like the Sound of Music, you know, where they're all going, oh, you know, off into the Alps singing. I doubt she was singing on the way, but anyways. You'd have to think somebody like her, you'd have to keep things simple and just walk by faith, not to be overwhelmed by the odds of making this kind of a trip in the first place. I mean, it was hard enough for that man who had left with the first 100 kids, let alone for little Gladys to take another 100 kids with her all the way over the mountains to the coast. It was pretty ridiculous. This was a really rough trip. They had little food and water, especially for Gladys, because she usually would wait till the kids had eaten and stuff first. You know, she wanted to make sure they were okay before she had anything. But God took care of them the whole way. I mean, everything from Chinese soldiers to Buddhist priests, like the most random people, showed them kindness along the way and provided for them. Not only that, but all the children stayed healthy all the way through the journey. Only Gladys started to become unwell, but you'll see why in a minute. So after 12 days, they were out of the mountains. So a week and a half walking through the mountains there, they get to the Yellow River. And it's like, okay, great, we've come this far, and now we have no way to get across the river. Excellent. And so because everybody in the nearby village had fled, there were no boats anywhere, there was no way for them to get across with all of these kids. So one of the boys reminded Gladys of Moses parting the Red Sea. Like, remember that story you told us about Moses parting the Red Sea? And she's like, oh, honey, I'm not Moses. It's not going to happen. And the boy said, no, but God is still God, right? It's like, ooh, she got dissed. Just like with the prison governor. Oh, that one hurt. So, but the simplicity of that, right? God is still God, right? Yes. And he's still the same God today. You know, this is a sweet little story and everything, but this is true in our lives if we're willing to believe and walk in that fact, right? That God is still God, and we really take him to be who he says that he is. So, simple faith and a great encouragement for Gladys. She was just like, whoa, you got me there, kid. So she started, she said, okay, well then you're right. God is still God. Let's pray. So they start praying and then they started singing some songs. And it just so happened that way downstream there were these Chinese soldiers. And as soon as they heard all this singing upstream, they're like, what the heck is that? You know, so they come to find out and they found a way to get them across the river. That was God's way of answering their prayers. I thought that was sweet. And it reminded me of 2 Chronicles 20, right? When Jehoshaphat, you know, they're being ambushed by Moab and Ammon and Mount Seir and all these nations coming against them. And it says, right, that when the people began to praise and sing, that the Lord set up ambushes against the enemy, right? So in worship and praising God, the answer arrived, right? The rescue came, the solution to the problem. And so that's exactly what happened here. So I thought that was a pretty neat example of, you know, just worshiping the Lord and look what happens. You know, God comes through and delivers. And so the journey continued on from here for several more days. The pace slowed down a little bit, but Gladys was just getting sicker and sicker. And so she was starting to get really discouraged and depressed. Eventually, they made it to the war haven, only to find out that there were too many refugees in the city, so it was closed. It's like, sweet, we came like, how many miles over the mountains? You got to be kidding me, you know? So kind of a bummer, but they finally found refuge in a nearby village. But by this time, Gladys was so ill that she was totally bedridden. And it was kind of like God just gave her exactly what she needed to get the kids over the mountains to safety, and then her body just completely gave out. And so it turned out that she had 105 degree temperature, which is ridiculous. I know. I'm like, good grief. How did she not, like, all her hair not burn off? That's like gnarly. The doctors discovered she had, that's weird, anyway, typhus, pneumonia, typhoid fever, relapsing fever. So she had like every fever on the earth. No wonder she had 105 degree temperature. And of course, to go along with that, naturally she was in a raving delirium. And so somehow she would get out of the hospital and go wander around the streets, not even knowing who she was or where she was. I mean, she was so completely out of it, like, oh! Anyway, sorry, I don't know why I'm laughing. It's terrible. But so it took a time, but eventually she started to recover a little bit. And she faced a lot of, like, physical, not just physical oppression, but spiritual oppression during this season. And she really had to hold on to the Lord and onto his promises to kind of get her through this season. It was a real rough time. So as she's in recovery, finally starting to come to her senses and not go wandering out in the streets all the time, you know, Linan, however you say it, came to see her, and he asked her to marry him. Whoa! So he's just like, yeah. It's like, I don't care how messed up you are from all these fevers. So he came and asked her to marry him, but something had changed since that time during the war. You know, it's war, and people fall in love, you know, and crazy things happen, and people get emotional. So now that all that was over, for whatever reason, the war had altered Gladys's perspective so much that she just couldn't go back to how things were for whatever reason. I don't know if it's just because she went through so much physically. She just wasn't in the place to do this. But she's like, I am so sorry. I just can't accept. And so she just knew before God, for whatever reason, she could not marry him. So kind of sad, really, and tragic, because they never saw each other again. That was it. So that was her. What? We'll never know, John, until we get to heaven. So anyways, I know it is kind of sad. I don't really know. He just kind of disappeared off the scene.
Click your computer.
He wasn't a Christian, though.
Oh, right? Upgrade to Mavericks. What the heck? Oh, do I need to do that?
Not now.
Okay. Thank you, John. Not now. You may not do that now. Okay. Yes. I don't know. That might be more what the issue was. At the end of the day, yeah, he wasn't a believer. But at the time, she would have been willing probably earlier during the war. Again, war makes you do crazy things, right? Kind of like being in foreign countries. People go nuts and do weird stuff. So anyways, yeah, so at the end of the day, yeah, things had changed. And he never had given his life to the Lord. That's probably a minor detail, huh? That's kind of important, actually. So they split up. It's now 1941. And the war is still going on, you know, obviously around the rest of the world, but in China there, you know, it was a different scene. And so, it hadn't just changed, you know, everything for Gladys and in terms of her relationship with Linan, but, you know, everything else had changed as well. She didn't really have anywhere to go now. She couldn't go back to Say Chow. She couldn't go back to Yangcheng. Her whole life was completely changed now. They're over the mountains. There was no going back to where they had been before. Because of the war and everything. And so she was a little bit displaced. The kids were, you know, starting, as, you know, they spent time there in that area, the kids were starting to get settled, you know, and they started to grow up, and they were leaving. So she didn't really have anything left to do. She tried working with various missions groups, but it didn't really work out well because she was so independent. You know, she had this me and God only kind of mindset. And so it was really difficult for her to work with other people, generally speaking. And so eventually she did join with a friend, this guy named Dr. Wang, and they ended up ministering to prisoners and lepers in an unreached region near the border of Tibet, which is pretty crazy. One missionary said, I thought this was a sweet little, you know, report of her ministry there. I remember a pint-sized missionary from England who had been with us out in West China for a year or so. She went into a leper colony to minister to lepers' needs. Before she came, the lepers were quarrelsome and jealous, fighting among themselves. Many of them felt life was hopeless. She came to tell them of a God who loved them. The tone of the colony changed. On the Friday evening before Easter, the local Chinese pastor and I visited the leprosarium to join in a Passion Week service. At the close of the service, we administered the Lord's Supper. We served bread and wine to men whose bodies were so twisted with disease that they could not kneel at the altar and whose hands were so deformed that they could hardly receive the elements. But their eyes were alight with new joy and hope. God had used this little missionary as his Barnabas to them. That's sweet. So she really made an impact there among the lepers. So China obviously is still in political upheaval. Gladys never felt completely safe there. Well, she never was completely safe there. She also still needed medical attention. All that stuff that had happened to her, it like jacked her up for a long time. So this is several years down the line, and she's still dealing with these, you know, recurring issues. And so in 1947, the Lord provided for her to go back home to England. And it had to be the Lord's timing, because just a couple years later, October of 1949, Mao Zedong came in and, you know, began Communist People's Republic of China, right? So the communist regime moved in, and you know, obviously Christians have lived under that oppression ever since. So Gladys was never totally comfortable back in London, not surprisingly, after all those years of being Chinese. But she spent several years there setting up areas for refuge for Chinese that were fleeing from communism. People were, you know, leaving China as fast as they could and coming over. So she did a lot of refugee work. She went around sharing about China at different churches, wherever she could. And so her reputation began to grow a little bit. Her biographer said she was labeled the parlor maid who became a missionary. It gave ordinary people the thought that they too could be used by God, which is sweet, right? Because she was. She was so, remember guys, she's a little maid who was completely rejected by the missions board, right? She was thought as completely unfit. But look at how the Lord used her in her simplicity. God calls ordinary, simple people. And all they need to do is know him, right? Right? Because the people who know their God will be and great exploits. Very good. Exactly. That's what we see here. Daniel 11:32. So in 1949, a journalist named Alan Burgess picked up Gladys's story and interviewed her. So he decided, oh, this is kind of a cool little story. This might be a nice little warm fuzzy we could put in a journal somewhere or a magazine. So at first he comes to interview her, and she simply said, and she just said, well, I don't really know what you want to know about my time in China. I don't think I really have anything interesting to say. It was just a lot of hard work over there. I mean, she really literally didn't think like that anything that she had to say would be that interesting. So she said, man, I worked really hard and got really sick. And so she genuinely believed nobody would be interested in her story. And so Burgess was kind of like, oh, great, this was a waste of my time. But he thought, well, while I'm here, I better be polite. And maybe I'll just ask her a few more specific questions. Like, okay, well, what happened, you know, after that lady Jeannie died? Did, you know, so he starts getting into more specifics, and she's like, yeah, well, there was this prison riot that broke. Yeah, that was kind of weird. And then the guy, like, handed me the act. You know, so she starts telling these stories, and the guy's like, you know, he's like, holy cow, this is nuts. And so he started to realize he had a pretty incredible story on his hands. And so he documents the whole thing from Gladys, and it first hit the general public actually as a radio program. They did a radio program of her life. I thought that was kind of interesting. And they used to do that back in the 40s and 50s. You know, they do dramatized radio productions of stories and stuff. I love listening to that stuff, old radio. I was born in the wrong era, definitely. I love all that stuff from the 40s but and 50s, but let's see. Anyway, so it goes on a radio program. Eventually, Burgess decided to write it out as a book about her entitled The Small Woman. So this is the original biography on Gladys Aylward. It's The Small Woman. And it inspired a major Hollywood motion picture in 1958 starring Ingrid Bergman. That's right. Major big-time actress back then, all right? I'm sure you guys are you guys familiar? No, I shouldn't say I'm sure because I'm sure half of you aren't. Ingrid Bergman, she's rad, okay? Who's seen Casablanca? Casablanca is the classic. All right, people have not seen Casablanca. In order to pass this class, you need to see that movie. I'm just kidding. You have to see it. So it's so good, man. There's so many good lines in that. You must remember this. I'll just sing to you. A kiss is still a kiss. Oh, it's so good. Anyways, okay, that's her, like, main, you know, is Casablanca, Gaslight, Suspicious. I mean, she's in all these good, like, Alfred Hitchcock movies, all kinds of stuff, all right? So Ingrid Bergman is bomb. But anyways, so she gets to star in this movie called The End of the Sixth Happiness. And there, whoops, that's not it. Whoa, oh, whoa, whoa. Oh, there she is. Okay. Now, it was a decent film, but it's kind of funny because the critics from Newsweek, they assumed that this was just some fictional story. You know, this, you know, whatever. And so they said, in order for a movie to be good, the story should be believable. Oh, no. It's like, oh, you don't even know, dude. This is like, I mean, they didn't even scratch the surface in the movie of all the things that she did do. And they thought this was unbelievable. I mean, let alone all the things that really did happen. So again, even fiction could not have invented something like this. So we see things that are definitely impossible and far-fetched in the eyes of man are the kinds of things that God likes to do, right? He makes them possible, and he does beyond those far-fetched, crazy things.
Is it the end of the eighth happiness?
That was, I don't know why, I can't remember why they changed it. I read about it and I forgot. They changed it in the movie to Sixth Happiness. I can't remember why. So, that's a great question. Somebody can do research on that. For extra credit. No, I'm just kidding.
They had the ninth with all these different virtues.
Oh, thank you. You know more about China than I do. Okay, yes. Okay. I haven't read it in a while. So I knew it had to do with, like, the virtues and the happinesses again, but I didn't know exactly. In the movie, they say, like, there are five virtues, and then the sixth one is whatever anybody creates for themselves. That's the sixth virtue or something like that. So by the time the movie came out, Gladys was a celebrity, but she was off ministering somewhere again. So unfortunately, she didn't get to screen the movie and keep Hollywood from changing her story. So again, the movie ended up being like not really quite what really happened. Some of it is, you know, the names of the people and stuff like that, but and some of the incidents, but they changed quite a few things. And so once she finally saw the movie, she was scandalized. She couldn't believe what they'd done to her life. For one thing, she really objected to the fact that they downplayed her Christian faith a lot. They didn't really emphasize that too much, but again, this is Hollywood. They're not going to, usually. She also objected to the film's location because they filmed End of the Sixth Happiness in Wales, and she's like, dude, Wales, that's like, those hills there, those are like speed bumps compared to the Chinese mountains. And I would have to agree, that's kind of weird that they, you know, but anyway, so they filmed it in Wales, and she thought that did no justice to Chinese, to the Chinese landscape. Also, the thing that was most appalling to her was the fact that they had love scenes between her and Lina and that guy. And she's like, oh, I never even kissed a man. She was so upset that they, like, put all that in there. And so, you know, them hugging and kissing and stuff like that. She was so upset. But, you know, I guess, well, and not only that, but, I mean, look at Gladys Aylward and look at Ingrid Bergman. I mean, they look absolutely nothing. Ingrid Bergman's like this big Swedish woman coming out here, like, and she has an accent and everything. I am going to tell you a story. You know, I mean, it's like, anyways, it just didn't really flow. And so, yeah. So all that to say, the whole thing was just like not anything even close. And so she was upset about it. But it did create interest in her work, in her ministry. And so on some level, there was some kind of blessing that came out of the whole thing. So What happened was, in 1957, her family had passed away. There was nothing to keep her in England, so she had moved to Hong Kong and then to Taiwan to minister there, open up orphanages, and assist refugees from mainland China. She served in that capacity the rest of her life, all the way till she died in 1970. She did go back to England one time to star on the show This Is Your Life, which was a popular show in, like, the 60s? Was that a 60s show, guys? Help me, people? Yeah, okay. This Is Your Life. So they'd have all these celebrities come on and do a whole thing. So,
can you find that on YouTube?
Taiwan and maybe Hong Kong. But her biographer says, and we're wrapping it up here, before long she was receiving invitations from all over Europe. In every European state she visited, she was entertained by royalty or heads of state. But Gladys never felt intimidated by important people because she was serving the King of Kings himself. And I love that, right? So no matter what notoriety she got, she was living for Jesus, and none of that really mattered. Knowing God, right, and walking in the simplicity of that was all that mattered to her. So that is Gladys Aylward. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, thank you so much, God, for this life and this radical story, Lord. But what really made it radical is the fact that you were the one working and doing all of these things. There's nothing, you know, particularly amazing about Gladys Aylward other than the fact that she was willing and obedient, Lord, and simply walk by faith with you, God, and you did all the work. You opened all the doors and did amazing things that nobody would have thought possible, God. And I pray that would encourage us in our own lives. We're all going to have different stories, and it's going to look differently for each and every one of us, but you want to do the impossible. You want to show yourself strong on our behalf, God. And so I just pray in Jesus' name that you would do that. Show yourself strong, Lord. Bring us to those places where we are at the end of ourselves and we see you come through and do great and mighty things, God. So bless each one here. Go before us as we carry on into the weekend. And as always, Lord, we just ask if you have any divine appointments, anything for us this weekend. We want to be open, have our eyes open to see what you would have us to see, Lord, to walk in your ways and whatever you would put before us. So we love you, God, and we commit it to you, and we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Okay.